Our reading today is called Now by Clifford Martin Reed. You are the eternal, the timeless. You would have us dance and sing in celebration of the present moment, but we can't see your smile or hear your song. But how will we find you if we don't look where you are? We search the past through its dusty libraries, its darkened ruins, its blood-soaked battlefields, but you are not there. We find only idols and people bowing down to them. Of you, there is but a whisper. Why do you seek the living among the dead? We search the future, straining our eyes to find you, but we see nothing, only our own mirages and maybes reflected back on fearful, hopeful faces. And we hear a whisper, do not be anxious about tomorrow. Tomorrow will look after itself. You are now, in us, with us. The present is your dwelling place. Call us out from bondage. Touch us with eternity. Free us from the drag of the past, the pull of the future. May we know you, love you, serve you, not yesterday, not tomorrow, but now, in this timeless moment. Amen. This month, we've been talking about prophecy and prophetic people who see a brighter and more just future. Today, we're in a requiem service for people who we now refer to in the past tense. Just a minute ago, you heard a reading titled Now, about being present. Future, past, present. They all tie together with our January theme of prophecy. The question you need to ask yourself when you leave today is, what am I going to do that is prophetic? Remember from our theme slide that you saw earlier today, prophets help us connect the dots between the world as it is and the world as it might be. Not only do prophetic people predict the future, they are consistent voices for justice. They ask everyone to align their actions with the highest, most loving, and most just values of their society. Perhaps most importantly, prophets live their values. Unitarian Universalism affirms and promotes seven principles drawn from six sources of our faith. The current language of the second source reads, words and deeds of prophetic people which challenge us to confront powers and structures of evil with justice, compassion, and the transforming power of love. Just a few examples of such prophetic voices include Amos, Jesus, Buddha, Gandhi, Dorothy Day, and Dr. King. In the last few weeks, Reverend Jim has been sharing with us the teachings of James Luther Adams. Despite not being a household name, he was arguably the most influential theologian of our faith in the 20th century. In the service 2 weeks ago titled Faith and Freedom, we learned that the essence of a church community is determined not by idolatry, but by its actions. He told us that James Luther Adams moved people to review their faith, to reconsider their beliefs, and how they put those beliefs into action. If we do so, we'll point the way toward being and becoming a congregation that points toward freedom for all, and the joy of life that will follow the establishment of those freedoms. This is what faith and freedom means for Unitarian Universalists. It is our outline for a better life. Last week, in a reflection titled, The Prophethood of All Believers, we heard this teaching from James Luther Adams. Prophets announce a crisis, often with fear and trembling, but they do so in order to shake people out of their pride. In other words, it's not just seeing ahead to where we're going or should be going, but doing something about it. This morning, you're going to hear about five people who passed away in 2017 after having made a notable impact on our world.
Dick Gregory died on August 19th of last year. He was 84. Gregory's career as a comedian got a jump start in 1961 when Hugh Hefner signed him to a 3-week contract at the flagship Playboy Club in Chicago, and he had many more appearances there. And of course, for such an audience, his humor had to have a wide appeal. So here are a few of his gags. I understand there are a great many Southerners here in this room tonight. I know the South very well. I spent 20 years there one night. Last time I was down south, I walked into this restaurant and this white waitress comes up to me and said, "We don't serve colored people here." I said, "That's okay, I don't eat colored people. I'll have the fried chicken." I sat at a lunch counter for 9 months. When they finally integrated, they didn't have what I wanted. But he also wasn't afraid to test the limits like comics of his time, as in the title of his 1964 autobiography. There it is there. After about a dozen years as a comic, he became less and less interested in show business and more interested in civil rights and an advocate for civil rights and a participant in civil disobedience. He was arrested hundreds of times. For example, here he is outside the South African embassy in the 1980s protesting apartheid. He also ran for president a few times. In recent years, he's best known for being a conspiracy theorist, you know, 9/11, the Kennedy assassination, and all that. However, his legacy as a civil rights leader can't be diminished. And here's a video from 1965. This is a few weeks after the Watts riots, where he prophetically rails against an evil that we're still contending with these days, 50 years on.
Every incident that have been tipped off in this country in the last 2 years up north have been tipped off by uniformed police. Now, I'm not saying the police is right or wrong. I'm saying when you have these incidents that's tipped off with this one symbol, then we should look into it and see what it is. When 22 million people, be they black or white, start hollering police brutality, then it's time to start listening to 22 million people and going in. A lot of people say, well, it's not police brutality. Police brutality is not when a cop necessarily knocks me upside the head. It's when a cop calls me nigger when he's making the arrest. It's when he handles me wrongly in every process of processing the arrest. This is a form of police brutality. And there's so few people that seem to understand that when the Negro says it's police brutality, then you say, well, he's just looking for a way out. Well, how do these many people look for a way out in so many areas in America? It's like Billy Graham, I think, made the statement of statements when he came into LA, and he said he thought the communists was behind the riots. And there's just not enough communists in Russia to stand on every corner in a Negro ghetto waiting for a cop to arrest a Negro and start a riot.
I became a part of this remembrance service just Friday evening. I didn't have any particular attachment or strong feelings about anyone who'd passed away in 2017. I didn't remember who'd passed away in 17. Time to search the web. I glanced at name after name, and none spoke to me until I encountered Solomon Duressa. Solomon Duressa, Ethiopian, poet, professor. The combination drew me in. Then I read one of his poems. That sealed the deal. I will be reading several lines from that poem at the close of my remembrance. To begin, let me place Solomon in his native land. He was born in Africa. He was born in that section of Africa, the section of the continent called the Horn of Africa, that bump out on the east coast. Within that bump are several countries, Ethiopia is the largest of them. Across and within the national boundaries, there are national and ethnic groups of ancient origin. Solomon was a proud Ethiopian whose roots were in the Oromo group. This map also indicates the extent of the Amhara group, the next in proportion size. Within these ethnic groups, dozens of varied local languages were then and are now spoken. So Solomon started life in Ethiopia, probably not in surroundings like this. Some of his relatives were officials of the national government. So he lived in an urban environment, more like this present-day view of the capital, Addis Ababa. Later, Solomon was able to come to the United States to study for a doctorate in philosophy at the University of Minnesota. He got the degree, a position at the university, taught and wrote poetry. Because of his activism against the repressive regime that seized power in Ethiopia, Ethiopia, he had to stay in this country from the 1980s until his death, November 2nd, 2017. A memorial service was held at the First Unitarian Society of Minneapolis. In closing, I will read the last three stanzas of Poem to the Matrix by Solomon Duressa. The saint and the hero are unwelcome here. Did I tell you that? Their ulterior motives are a given. They lack the blinding speed and the curls into immobility, the no mind of the sperm, the ovum's hospitality. The drying river, the crumbling mountain, the sand that rides the wind, and the twice 44 tongues of the horn do not recognize them. They speak of ancestral glory and tomorrow's promise to the millennium, unaware that though they utter every name, there will yet be unuttered names, always. And tongues of flame will lick again. Words like wetland weeds will reach for the sun, and young women will smile for no reason at all and silently ask, how did this all begin? I wish I had known him while he was here. And that, in a way, is a kind of mourning.
It's a pleasure to be with you today. I actually volunteered Reverend Jim to speak about UUA moderator Jim Key. This is what happens when you're a lifespan religious educator. You think you need a Unitarian Universalist in the group, and I didn't know that we had at least some affiliation. But I do think that it's important to speak about Jim Key, and I don't know how many people actually knew him. I had not heard of him until early last year. Let me tell you something. He was raised a Methodist, and he found Unitarian Universalism fairly well into his adult life, actually. He had been diagnosed with cancer. He was given a 1% chance to live, and he said that he believed in that moment he would be part of the 1%. And during the course of his therapies, he met a Presbyterian minister. And he spoke with her about religion, and she said, you know, I think you're a Unitarian Universalist. And that was unusual, and he said, oh, I should go check it out. And then he asked her about where she was ministering, and she said, well, right now I'm not, because she and her wife were not welcome to minister there. That minister actually then became fellowshipped with the Unitarian Universalist Association. But that moment brought Jim Key into the faith. And that from then, he actually started getting very involved in his congregation. That same minister together, they built the congregation, and he He was a very active lay person there. He became the congregation's president for 5 years. He had also had a long career at IBM and his own business. And he thought it was astonishing that he had never heard about Unitarian Universalists in all of his travels, and he, you know, all around, until he met this Presbyterian. But he said, "I want UUs to find people who seek a liberal, liberating faith, but do not know that we are here." And so that became his mission. So after he had been congregational president, he actually then went on to serve in the district that was then known as the Thomas Jefferson District. He had heard from before his time that there was a terrible thing had happened at the 1993 General Assembly when the organizing committee had sent out invitations for the Thomas Jefferson Ball, and the invitations urged folks to wear period costume. One African-American UU, a delegate at that time, said, "You want me there in rags and chains?" And from that moment, there became a wider conversation about what that name meant for folks. So when Jim came into this position in the district, he knew that legacy, and there had been a couple of votes to change the name, but it had not passed. He recognized that that name itself was keeping Unitarian Universalism back from folks who would otherwise want to be there. And so he made it one of his priorities, and he went from congregation to congregation. He recognized that when the board vote didn't work, he needed to speak to individuals. And he was a very good listener. And from person to person, he spoke and ended up changing individual minds and hearts. And in that period, Dr. Leon Spencer, who knew him, they worked in the district together. They began calling the district the TJ District. And it was Thomas Jefferson, right? But it was also toward justice. And in 2011, the congregations brought forth a motion to change the name to the Southeast District, and it passed. So I think that's one of the most amazing things that he did, because he saw that story and that need, and he made sure that everyone was able to get on board. And he went and spoke to the folks who were disappointed, because there's a lot of conflicting emotions around Thomas Jefferson. Well, in 2013, Key was elected the UUA moderator. That's a position that involves service on the UUA board and also supervising our general assemblies. When Peter Morales resigned as UUA president early in 2017, Key shepherded the appointment of the Reverend Dr. Sophia Betancourt, who you see here, the Reverend William Sinkford, and Dr. Leon Spencer. And you see them all here along with one other person who was supporting that transition. That was on April 10th. So this transformation and support of the congregations as we went through that difficult period in 2017 is also a gift. I wanted to tell you, so Jim had his remarks, but I had a few things I wanted to add. I wanted to tell you something that Reverend Rob Eller Isaacs, the UUA secretary, said at Jim's memorial. He said, "Jim loved how hard we try to tell the truth." And that's a great thing. The other piece that I thought was really amazing about the memorial service was when Trustee Alondria Williams spoke. She said that she had known Key since she was very young. Key had asked her to serve on the board and to be his accountability partner. She said that he told her, "I trust you to say to me when I'm going off course, because you always have. You are the one helping me hold this faith to where it could and should be." That vision and that understanding and that belief in the transformative power of our faith is one of Jim Key's most amazing legacies. I'd like to share a little video of him now.
Power. Imagine a healthy Unitarian Universalist community that is alive with transforming power, moving in our communities and the world towards more love, more justice, and more peace.
We won.
May it be so.
It's knowing that your door is always open and your path is free to walk. That makes me tend to leave my sleeping bag rolled up and stashed behind your couch. And it's knowing I'm not shackled by forgotten words and bond and the ink stains that have dried upon some life. And that keeps you on the back roads by the rivers of my memory. It keeps you ever gentle on my mind.
Good morning. My name is Tracy Yingling. And Gentle on My Mind, Glen Campbell's signature song, is one of the many country music songs that form the musical backdrop of my childhood, as my parents were both avid country music listeners. Glen Campbell was born in April 1936, the seventh son in a family with 12 children. His father was a sharecropper in Arkansas, where Glen and his brothers and sisters would help on their family farm, as well as pick cotton and tomatoes as field hands. Glen's dad bought him his first guitar when he was 4 years old. It was a three-quarter size guitar that he ordered through the mail, and he ordered it because his son's hands were too small to use the full-size guitars that his brothers played. Glen was a natural and could play anything he heard once, but he never learned to read music. In 1960, he moved west to Hollywood with his second wife to pursue his music dreams. His virtuoso playing and guitar solo work resulted in Glen's becoming one of the most in-demand guitar players, working with the well-known elite session band called the Wrecking Crew. With the group, Glen recorded with music superstars Elvis Presley, Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Tina Turner, Phil Spector, The Monkees, Jan and Dean, The Beach Boys, and many others. In 1963, Glen would play in 586 sessions. He called it going from one heaven to another. His session work led to minor success with his own solo work, and in 1965, he was actually briefly one of the Beach Boys, subbing for Brian Wilson for 6 months. From 1967 to 1977, Glen became a crossover music star, topping both pop and country charts with songs like the iconic Gentle on My Mind, Wichita Lineman, Galveston, and By the Time I Get to Phoenix. In 1969, at his peak of stardom, Glen sold more records than the Beatles. Starred in the Glen Campbell Good Time Hour music variety show on television, and acted with his friend John Wayne in True Grit. As is often the case, however, fame led to Glen struggling with alcohol and drug use, as well as the end of his second marriage. From 1975 through 1980, Glen's career waned. He had another failed marriage, and his life was splashed across the tabloid headlines. In an era when alcohol and drugs took the lives of music stars like Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin and his longtime friend, Elvis Presley, Glen credits his turnaround in 1981 to surviving a one-time experience freebasing cocaine in Las Vegas, a talk with his friend Loretta Lynn, meeting Kim Woolen, the woman who would become his fourth and final wife, and with her, his rededication to his faith. Through it all, however, Glen had his music. His career spanned 5 decades with 73 top 40 hits on both pop and country charts, as well as over 20 Grammy, Academy of Country Music, and American Music Awards for singles and albums of the year, both country and pop recording artists of the year, and a Career Lifetime Achievement Award. His final Grammy Award, Best Country Song of 2015, was for I'm Not Gonna Miss You. It was a song featured in the documentary about his battle with Alzheimer's disease, filmed during his farewell tour for what he thought would be his final studio album, Ghost on the Canvas, and during which his 3 youngest of 8 children would join his backup band playing drums, guitar, and banjo.
Music I guess it's one of the first things he ever learned, and it's the most deeply embedded in his memory. And from speaking to some music therapists that we met during the filming of the documentary, according to them, music utilizes all of your brain, not just one little section. And the doctors said that they felt like continuing to do music had actually helped him plateau and maintain, you know, his functions. Not gonna miss you.
74, Glenn was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. He, his wife Kim, and their family felt it was important to share their experience with the progression of the disease through the 2014 documentary, Glenn Campbell, I'll Be Me. Kim describes the prophetic central song, I'm Not Gonna Miss You, as Glenn's farewell song. In his words, I'm not gonna be able to miss anyone anyway. Members of the Wrecking Crew, his old session band members, helped to record the song, bringing his singing career full circle. Glenn would actually release two more studio albums, I'll See You There and Adios. Glenn left us on August 8th, 2017.
How would you like to be remembered?
Just for what I am. That's, you know, it's, I'm Glenn Campbell, and I believe in God, and I believe in other people, like the way you want to be treated, and to help others less fortunate.
Music is really incredible, you know, it's just, it's something you just, it's a gift. And I try to do that. And wow. I'm thankful. It's no knowing that the door's always open and your
path is free to walk. You've all seen this before, right? This is Captain Bruce McCandless, naval aviator, electrical engineer, and astronaut. NASA selected him for training in 1966. He served as capsule communicator in the Apollo and Skylab programs, and that's the person that talks to the crew from Mission Control. You probably thought the guy's name was Houston. He happened to be Apollo 11's Capcom, so he was the Houston talking to Neil Armstrong on the first moonwalk in 1969. McCandless flew two historic flights on the space shuttle, the first aboard the Challenger in 1984. His mission was testing the MMU, Manned Maneuvering Unit. He had spent 12 years prior to that helping to design and build it. And that was the first time a human being ever flew free in space, untethered to the spacecraft. That was a very, very big deal. On the second mission in 1990, he and his crewmates aboard Discovery deployed Hubble Space Telescope, also a very big deal. He died in December at age 80. In 1984, I was a rookie engineer at the Johnson Space Center in Houston. I worked in space shuttle flight operations, where I had a front row seat to history in the making, where I bore witness to both triumph and tragedy. I knew some of the astronauts personally, but I had only one fleeting encounter with McCandless shortly before his first flight. My office was next door to the WETF, Weightless Environment Training Facility, and that's a big swimming pool housed in a repurposed airplane hangar. In training exercises, astronauts are dunked in the pool wearing suits that are weighted just precisely so they don't sink or float, and that mimics the weightlessness they experience in space. The WETF had airplane-sized garage doors that roll up, and they were usually open when the weather was good. So one nice day, passing by, I saw a man in a spacesuit just dangling inside the door like a slab of meat on a meat hook. It was a strange sight. Technicians were all around him adjusting things, and I knew who he was. His upcoming mission was generating a lot of excitement. I did a double take. His eyes met mine. He gave me a little wave and grinned as if to say, I know this looks silly, but I'm having a lot of fun. A few weeks later, I squeezed into a crowded conference room and watched on NASA's closed circuit television as he exited the orbiter's airlock and flew away. And then a coworker elbowed me and whispered, his family is here. And so they were. M- McCandless's parents and two children. Their pride and excitement were palpable, and also their hearts were in their throats. Mine was too. We all knew that if something went wrong, there could be terrible consequences. That was an unforgettable day. And Challenger returned safely to Earth a few days later, mission accomplished. An astronaut has to have curiosity. He has to wonder what's out there, work very hard, and risk life and limb to find out. An astronaut has to have vision to imagine a future world and help create it. In space, astronauts from many nations leave their differences far, far behind and work side by side for a better future for all of us. It's a beautiful thing. So, Bruce, I salute you at the conclusion of your incredible Earth life. May your spirit fly forever free.
Thank you to our musicians and to all of our speakers for sharing these remembrances of notable people who passed away in 2017. I asked you earlier to answer this question when you leave here. What am I going to do that is prophetic? Be inspired by Dick Gregory and advocate for civil rights. Follow the example of Solomon Deressa and write a poem that challenges outmoded conventions. Take after Jim Kay and introduce a kindred spirit to Unitarian Universalism. Remember Glen Campbell and sing a song that brightens someone's day. Think of Bruce McCandless and inspire a child to be curious about science. Quoting from the Unitarian Universalist Association website, a contemporary prophetic church is on the cutting edge, reading the signs of its times, creating a just and loving community in the midst, and advocating passionately for a better world. Through consistently taking small steps as individuals and as a group, Northlake is and can remain such a prophetic church. May it be so.